Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Scriptures Through the Ages. My guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High School, the Bible, government, and history. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets. We've been talking in this whole series, this is number 20, on the Scriptures, and we're not just talking on the Scriptures in order to be able to understand the history, and which we're trying to do, and all the influences through the ages, but hopefully that we would appreciate the Scriptures and read them. If we never read the Scriptures, then we, as Jerome said, to be ignorant of the Scriptures is to be ignorant of Christ. Now, as Catholics, we conduct the Scriptures every time we come to Mass, four times on Sunday, and we come during the week, three Scripture readings, first reading, Psalm, and the Gospel. So we have a lot of personal contact through the liturgy, but a personal reading of the Scriptures we want to encourage too. Well, Ron, I think maybe you could give us a little review of where we've been of the 19th century liberal modernist Protestantism approach to the sacred scriptures.
Okay. Well, we had spent a good dozen sessions dealing with the Enlightenment of the 18th century. And during that time, there was an excessive emphasis on reason and the intellect. And a lot of the scripture scholarship at that time, for the most part, tended to tear down the Bible. Whereas the 19th century was an excessive emphasis on emotion and the will, and we're just getting into that right now. Historians have called the 19th century the Romantic period, or the Age of Romance, and in part it was a revolt against the calculating intellectualism and rationalism of the Enlightenment that we looked at in some detail when we looked at people like Descartes and Hume and Kant and other such philosophers, as well as against traditional social and political norms. And as we said, Romanticism affected almost all fields of endeavor, including philosophy, religion, and especially art, music, and literature. Most people are familiar with the impact that Romanticism had on, you know, literature, you know, with an emphasis on the emotions and the bizarre, mystery, things of that sort, as opposed, you know, to the more intellectual, calculating,
sort of the mystical. No, there was a lot of, used to read a lot of poetry, emphasized particularly feelings and emotion, which was good, but it was that whole era.
As one scholar has written, quote, beginning in the 18th century and continuing through the century that followed, the epistemological revolution launched by Descartes and Kant merged the developments in archaeology, history, and biblical study to produce a radical shift in the thinking of some theologians. Among other things, the historical value of the Gospels and the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, came under attack. End of quote. Now, one could say that the 19th century saw the beginning of the critical movement in biblical scholarship, and by critical movement I mean the application of modern scientific methodology to the study of the Bible. And we briefly looked at this method during our series Understanding the Bible. Recall that a few sessions ago, when discussing biblical interpretation during the 17th century, we pointed out that most historians considered Richard Simon or Ricard Simon, I think that's how they pronounce it in French, or close to that anyway, who happened to be a Catholic, to be the father of modern biblical criticism. We also discussed Hermann Samuel Ramirez, who was an 18th century German philosopher of the Enlightenment, who is remembered for his deism, which according to one source is the doctrine that human reason can arrive at knowledge of God and ethics from the study of nature and our own internal reality, thus eliminating the need for religions based on revelation. That theme, end of quote. That theme is going to be extremely important as we start taking a look at a number of biblical scholars in the early to mid and on through the 19th century, and then some Catholic biblical scholars toward the end of the 19th century. As we discuss, such a view denies the possibility of miracles and prophecies. I read that some scholars credit him with being the initiator of the investigation of the historical Jesus, which we're soon going to be looking at. This view considered Jesus just a simple religious teacher rather than a divine person of traditional doctrine. And we'll have a lot to say about the debate over the historical Jesus in later sessions. After Ramirez, the most dominant scripture scholars throughout the 19th century were Protestants, mainly German Lutherans, several of whom we will begin to examine today. And we also consider George Friedrich Wilhelm Hegel in our last session, a 19th century German philosopher whose dialectical idealism greatly influenced subsequent biblical scholars such as David Frederick Strauss.
Well, good. Now that we have finished this little summary of where we've come from, let's go back, Ron, to the main Protestant German scripture scholars of the early 19th century.
One of the most prominent was Gottfried Eichhorn. He was a Lutheran professor of Oriental languages at the University of Jena, or Jena, if you'd say it in English, and subsequently Göttingen. Philip Trauer, in his Turmoil and Truth, tells us that after he published his introduction to the Old Testament from 1780 to 1783, and his introduction to the New Testament, which was published during the years 1804 and 1812, the movement was, from then on, was, quote, quoting Trauer now, dominated by scholars whose conclusions about the time and the way the biblical books were written were influenced as much by philosophical assumptions and cultural prejudices as by concrete evidence, end of quote. He illustrates his point by saying that, quote, their principal assumption was that supernatural phenomena like miracles and prophecies are impossible, and therefore a large part of the Bible must be folklore. They also tended to see people in the past as necessarily inferior, uninterested in objective truth, and incapable of transmitting facts accurately, while regarding priests as by nature deceitful and only interested in the maintenance of their collective authority. I'm still quoting now. Evidence that the art of writing was practiced by the Hebrews at least by the time of the Exodus, and the capacity of non-literate peoples to orally transmit religious traditions faithfully over long periods of time was either downplayed or ignored. These assumptions had in most cases already been made before they set to work, end of quote. If we had time, we could look at every one of those and the points that he makes there. There's a whole story behind each one of those. And we will have occasion to kind of touch on some of those as we go along through the rest of the series, and then on another series that we've been working on that will look at what's in the Bible, the content of the Bible, and not just how it's been interpreted. But nonetheless, the Pentateuch and the Gospels were the main objects of attention by these scripture scholars, these Lutheran and German scripture scholars throughout the early and mid 19th century.
All right, and it seemed like they're always trying to put down, degrade miracles and any kind of revelation, because they start out with that assumption, as you said, miracles aren't possible and God can't intervene from the outside with revelation, so we have to explain the Bible in some kind of humanistic terms.
Yeah, their assumptions were based primarily on the idea that modern man, with all of our science and technology and that kind of thing, simply won't believe that miracles and prophecies that come true and all that kind of thing happen. And so They themselves didn't believe it, and they didn't believe that other people would believe it either. And so that's one of the reasons, that's one of the motivations behind their urge to, you know, reinterpret the Bible, to reconstruct the Bible.
Okay, I like that to reconstruct word.
Well, they destruct it first. They got to destruct it, or okay, demythologize it, as Bultmann was to call it in the 20th century. And, of course, Spinoza had advocated that kind of demythologization, or this kind of destruction. And then, of course, once you tear it apart and in a million little fragments or pieces, and then you can come back in there and get the pieces and build your own little religion, your own little utopian, this worldly, secular, you know, oriented religion.
Of course, that's still happening today, and we'll be talking about it down the line not too long.
It's the main motivation of the Jesus Seminar, for example, that we'll be looking at.
All right. Didn't we briefly discuss the interpretation of the Pentateuch in an earlier session, these first five books of Moses?
Yes, so we won't go over it again, except to quote Philip Trower, who writes in his Turmoil and Truth that, quote, the question about the composition of the Pentateuch is not when were the books written or put together in the form we now have them, but was the information they contain, whether recorded by Moses or others, transmitted accurately down through the centuries, end of quote. He writes in regard to the New Testament that, quote, that was the Old Testament, of course, in the New Testament, quote, the critical question about the composition of the Gospels is, were they or were they not written by eyewitnesses or by men with more or less direct access to eyewitnesses, end of quote. In answer to this question, Trower says, quote, to both questions, the critical conclusions tended toward a negative answer, end of quote.
So they weren't based on accurate truth being handed down.
That's correct. Eichhorn, Julius Wellhausen, we just mentioned Eichhorn a while ago. Wellhausen, we talked about him in our series, Understanding the Bible, and his documentary theory that was applied, or hypothesis that was applied to the Pentateuch. And others essentially reduced the Old Testament to folklore in their scholarship. But as Trower says, it wasn't so easy for them to dismiss the New Testament miracles as myths and the Gospels as patchworks of folklore, as they had done, of course, with the Old Testament.
Okay.
He writes, quote, between the death of Christ and the writing of the Gospels, there was no long centuries during which myths could form and orally transmitted information become garbled. The best the critics could do was to date the Gospels as long after the death of the last eyewitnesses as possible. This, in a sense, is what a great part of New Testament scholarship outside the Catholic Church has ever since been about, end of quote. You see, the later it could be established that the Gospels were written, the more likely they weren't written by eyewitnesses and thus reflected the beliefs of the Christian community of the day, rather than what necessarily really happened. And I hope to make a detailed look at some of these New Testament issues when we examine the content of the Bible in another series that we've been working on. But there have always been people trying to undermine the integrity of the Bible, unfortunately, including some Catholic biblical scholars. But there are highly satisfactory answers to their false allegations.
So that has been true, it is true now, and it probably always will be true. In your beautiful statement there have always been people trying to undermine the integrity of the Gospel, or that it's believable, or that it's, that we can put our stake our lives on it, that we can live by it.
Certainly this is true from the very beginning.
Okay, now weren't the Protestant scholars of this period greatly influenced by the Enlightenment philosophers that we discussed before, especially men like Immanuel Kant?
Yes, there's no doubt that these Protestant biblical scholars were greatly influenced by the pervasive influence of the Enlightenment. According to Trower, In great part, this trend was marked by the denial of the historical truth of many miracles in sacred scripture and of scripture's divine authorship and authority. Quoting him here, the books of the Bible were considered to be merely profane documents written by different groups of people with their own political and personal goals, end of quote. We discussed in earlier sessions how Baruch, or Benedict, after he changed his name from the Jewish Baruch to an anglicized or an English version, Benedict Spinoza, had first applied some of these ideas to the Old Testament. And now Hermann Samuel Ramirez applied them to the New Testament. We're going to say a little bit more about Ramirez later on, though. Now, in the 19th century, we find Protestant biblical scholars such as Eichhorn, whom we mentioned a little while ago, as well as men like Ferdinand Christian Bauer, Bruno Bauer. Now, these are spelled differently. Christian Bauer was B-A-U-R. Bruno Bauer is B-A-U-E-R. Friedrich, we would say Frederick in English, Schleiermacher. We're going to spend a lot of time on Schleiermacher because he's so important. Albrecht Reichel, which would be in English, Albert, and David Friedrich Strauss, as well as the Catholic Ernst Renan, or Ernest Renan in English, who, you know, all of these applied this rational system. And Trout states that each of these scholars had his own theory, but, quote, the ultimate conclusion of them all was that the Bible contained either falsified history or edifying myths, and that we can really know very little about what Jesus Christ really said and did, end of quote. As we will discuss in a later session, this is the essence of the current Jesus seminar that just about everyone has heard about, thanks to PBS and the History Discovery and similar channels.
Okay, so even putting the Catholic Ernst Renan in there, he was doing the same thing, taking the divinity out of Jesus, that he was a wonderful philosopher, wonderful teacher of good and bad, but that he certainly wasn't God.
And Renan had a lot of influence on Alfred Loisy, who was, of course, a Catholic priest scholar in the end of the 19th century. In fact, he actually had attended his classes at the university. I think it was the University of Paris.
Really?
And Loisy, of course, ended up outside the church. In fact, he was excommunicated but we'll talk about Loisy in four or five sessions down the line.
Okay, well, wasn't Renan also outside the church?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, you mentioned Ferdinand Christian Bauer, B-A-U-R. What can you tell us about him?
He was the founder of the Tübingen School in Germany. Tübingen, named after the Tübingen University, an old university in Germany, who concentrated on the way the myths of the gospel developed instead of how the apostles invented the myth. Tarr says that Bauer explained the development of the gospel, quote, in terms of Hegel's theory, that progress takes place through the clash of contradictory ideas, end of quote. This is why we spent a little bit of time on Hegel, because Hegel had a lot of influence on people like Bauer and Strauss and people like that.
His dialectical.
Yes, and we'll see. In fact, Trower explains how Bauer applied this Hegel's dialectical idealism to the Bible, to the gospel. He says, quote, according to Bauer, a conservative Jewish party under St. Peter and St. James, that's the thesis, came into conflict with the Gentile-oriented party under St. Paul, that's the antithesis of the antithesis, and then the eventual result was a compromise, or the clash of ideas or whatever, however you want to put it, was a compromise, this is the synthesis, from which sprang the Catholic Church. That's a big theme in this liberal type of biblical interpretation, that there was a dichotomy between St. Paul and St. Peter. And they like to really stress that. We won't get into that in this series much. That'll be something we'll look at more when we get into another series looking what's in the Bible. But nonetheless, St. Matthew's and St. Mark's Gospels represent the conservative view, according to Bauer, in the Tubingen school, and St. Luke's Gospel and St. Paul's Epistles, that of the innovators, and the Joannine writings, not from the pen of St. John, he's telling us here, because they didn't believe that John wrote the Gospel of John, a lot of these modern scripture scholars, beginning in the 19th century. He goes on to say, the standpoint of the party of compromise. Bauer attributed the bulk of the New Testament to the late 2nd century. He was one of the first critics to regard the Gospels as primarily a record of the early Christians' collective thinking rather than a record of events and facts. End of quote. And Trier concludes his discussion of Bauer by saying, quote, however, he was at least honest enough to admit that if the Gospels were written by eyewitnesses or the friends of eyewitnesses, his theories fell to the ground, end of quote.
Boy, that's an unusual statement.
Yeah, that's a big thing, and we'll look at more details when we get into another series on that, but there's always been an attempt by these modern scripture scholars to push back the dates that the Gospels were written. And the farther you could do that, some of them have pushed them back as far as the late 1st century, even into the early 2nd century. So obviously, it couldn't have been written, for the most part, by eyewitnesses. Now, we know that John wrote his gospel toward the end of the 1st century. I mean, he was 90-some years old, probably, when he wrote it. He was a young boy, of course, when Christ was, walking the earth. These are points that we'll come back and stress a little more later.
Okay, well, let's continue that line of thought, Ron. You said that Bruno Bauer attributed the bulk of the New Testament, most of the New Testament, to the late 2nd century. Does it make any difference when the Gospels were written, as long as they were inspired by God?
It probably wouldn't make any difference if it weren't for the fact that people assume that the greater the span of time between the occurrence of an event and its being recorded in writing, the less likely the record is to be true. As I said a while ago, we'll address this issue more in another series, but biblical scholars still use the tactic of trying to push back the date of the gospel's composition, with the intent of trying to undermine their credibility. They believe that the later it can be established that the Gospels were written, the less likely what is written in them is true. And moreover, as we discussed in some detail during our series in the Da Vinci Code, some scholars try to prove that the Gnostic Gospels were written even before the four Gospels. And I think we put that to bed in that series. But they do this to make the Gnostic Gospels seem more credible, even claiming the four Gospels were based on them. And there are all kinds of programs that are coming out all the time on television and in books that are coming out. You can go into any bookstore, and there's dozens of books there that are making talking about these so-called Gnostic Gospels that we talked about in our series Understanding the Bible, and in some detail in the Da Vinci Code.
And those were the Gospels that the church, when it determined the books that belong in the Bible, said were counterfeit, that they really weren't accurate. Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, Gospel of James. Okay, you mentioned that Bruno Bauer, what role did he play in early Protestant biblical scholarship in Germany? It seems like so much of this historical criticism is coming out of Germany.
It was. Bruno Bauer lived much of the 19th century and was a German theologian, philosopher, and historian. And from his New Testament studies, he concluded that early Christianity owed more to Greek philosophy, especially Stoicism, than to Judaism. That's a big theme that you'll see in a lot of this modern scripture scholarship even today. A lot of these modern scripture scholars say that a lot of biblical interpretation of the church's interpretation is Hellenic or Greek. Yeah, most people have probably heard that. They may not know what it means, but that's where it's coming from. He also published a series of controversial works in which he argued that Jesus was a second century fusion of Jewish, Greek, and Roman theology. In other words, a myth. According to Trower, for Bauer, quote, Christianity originated with the author of St. Mark's Gospel, and I'll get this, an Italian living in the Emperor Hadrian's time. This was, now where he got that, I don't know. He just obviously made that up. who never intended his book to be anything but a work of fiction. I'm quoting here now. Nevertheless, the idea got around that the hero was a real person. A sect of admirers formed, and the other New Testament books followed. Bauer eventually lost his teaching post, end of quote.
Wow.
Even in 19th century Germany, he lost it. I think one can readily see that all of the wild assertions of the 19th century biblical scholars, at least these early ones, have no basis in fact and nothing more than wild guesses. Nonetheless, a lot of these ideas in some form or another are still floating around in the biblical scholarship world. And Trier concludes his discussion of the early critical biblical scholarship movement by saying, quote, such roughly were the beginnings of the biblical critical movement. The Bible, it would seem, is like an atomic reactor. Anyone working on it without the protective coating of prayer and reverence rapidly has his faith burned to cinders, end of quote.
Wow.
And I would add to this the protective coating of a magisterial church, of course, which, for the most part, Lutherans had denied, you know, and almost all Protestants had denied the idea of a teaching church in the sense that Catholics think of a teaching church.
Now, part of the problem, obviously, was there was some truth in things, not what the last guy was saying.
Sure, yeah, that was a little kind of far out.
Boy, that's the farthest I've ever heard anybody that stated the Gospel of Mark was written by...
Well, about as far out as one of the scholars who claimed that Jesus was born of a prostitute. Mary was either that or she was raped by a Roman soldier or something like that. So.
They were teaching that not too long ago in a Catholic seminary. One of our seminarians came back and said that's what they heard in the Catholic seminary.
I'm not surprised. But anyway,
the whole thing was we need protection. We need guidance. We need a compass to direct us. And a lot of these people are beginning to study the Scripture not to be inspired, but to destroy the Scripture.
Yeah, they're looking for some way to destroy traditional religion so they can build on it some new utopian religion and system on the ruins.
Kind of a humanistic
Yes, a secular way. Humanistic
secular
society,
humanism.
Yes.
Okay, well, I think our time is running out, and thanks, Ron, so much for your great historical work on this. To our audience, we say may God bless you now, always, and in all ways.